Anatomy and Physiology, the Endocrine System, Part 2. We're going to start with the thyroid gland with the anatomy, and then we'll dive into the physiology. Here's a beautiful picture from your book showing the low mag view and then the thyroid gland and other neck anatomy blown up into a larger view. So let's take a look at this butterfly-shaped, pinkish-looking gland called the thyroid gland. It is located inferior to the larynx or below the voice box. It has two lateral lobes on either side of the trachea, and the thyroid gland lateral lobes are connected by a small piece going across here called an isthmus. Now, I always have trouble saying that word, so don't laugh at me. That's a term I think that's also used in geography, but in any case, you know how to say it at home. Here's the real deal gross anatomy picture showing you the right lateral lobe, the left lateral lobe, and then the connecting piece called the isthmus. Now we dive into some histology. Sort of a weak picture from your book, I hate to say that, but over here on the left side, this is the thyroid gland in a drawing. The thyroid gland is mostly made up of a whole bunch of roundish-like sacs that are called thyroid follicles. And follicles means like a little bag or a little sac. That's how I know I'm looking at a thyroid gland under the microscope. I just see hundreds of round fluid-filled sacs. And follicular cells, shown here in purple, make up the walls of each follicle. So that's not rocket scientist, or that's not rocket science. And the follicular cells produce the thyroid hormones. And the thyroid hormones, by definition, are T3 and T4. We have to know what they stand for. T3 stands for triiodothyronine because there's three iodines in it. And T4, there are two synonyms for that you should know. It's called either thyroxine or tetraiodothyronine. And tetra stands for there are four iodines in T4. Thyroxine, by the way, get to know that name because some people take thyroid supplements, and if you look on the bottle of Synthroid, it's just synthetic thyroxine, so that's what's in that bottle. Some more anatomy. The lumen, or the interior of the follicle, contains the stored hormone material, and that sticky, liquidy, hormony soup stuff is called colloid, C-O-L-L-O-I-D. There are some other cells in the thyroid gland shown here in pink. They are called parafollicular cells. Let the name help you. Para means near. These are cells that lie in between the follicles. They also produce a hormone. The hormone is calcitonin, which is spelled on another slide, by the way. So these are all the hormones made by the thyroid gland, and this is where they're made. Here's a histological preparation, no new information here. It shows you one of these sac-like structures that I'm circling called a thyroid follicle, which is lined by cells called follicular cells. And this pink soup in the middle is the hormone soup called colloid. That's where we store a lot of our thyroid hormones, T3 and T4. Another drawing, no new information here. If you like this and this helps you, you can look at it. Showing again a follicle with the purple follicular cells. And then, of course, in red we have capillaries. Our endocrine organs rich in capillaries because, you know, these substances are secreted into the blood. Another picture, just a drawing from your textbook showing the parafollicular cells that are in between the follicles. shown again in pink color. That's where the calcitonin comes from, by the way. We have to do some biochemistry here. This is one of those long multi-step pathways that you're going to have to get down. We all have to do it one time. I'll roll through it here with you, and then you'll have to sit down at home and do it a half a dozen times before you get it. But this is important because there are a lot of diseases of the thyroid gland. It's important to understand how it works, and that way you can understand what's going on in your patients and you can help them better or maybe come up with some new medications or new cures for thyroid disease. So let's discuss the formation, storage, and release of thyroid hormones. First, I have to give you an orientation of what your book did here. These cells here in yellow are the follicular cells. So this would go around in a great big circle because this is highly magnified. This pinkish stuff in the middle, this is the colloid. This is the hormone soup, so to speak. This here in pink is a capillary. Very important to have capillaries richly invested into our endocrine tissues because that's how we get our hormones into our system, so to speak. So here's the deal. Our follicular cells, shown here in yellow, first they trap the iodine from our blood. In other words, the follicular cells suck the iodide out of our blood. As a matter of fact, the thyroid gland contains most of the iodide in the body. Next, step two, the follicular cells synthesize a protein called thyroglobulin, which everybody abbreviates TGB. Step number three, the follicular cells release both the thyroglobulin and the iodide into the lumen of the follicle. The next step is called iodination of tyrosine. Tyrosine is an amino acid on that protein called TGB. And what happens is we bind either one or two iodines to the amino acid tyrosine, which is on the thyroglobulin, to form either T1 or T2. If we put one iodine on it, it's called T1. If we put two iodines on it, it's called T2. Again, it's not hard or I wouldn't do it. The next step in this long chain is called coupling of T1 and T2. In other words, we could join one T1 and one T2 together to form T3, or we could join two of the T2 molecules together and form, you guessed it, T4. So we have now T3 and T4, which are the thyroid hormones, in the colloid soup. So if your body wants it and needs it, what happens next? The follicular cells, again shown here in yellow, will uptake the thyroglobulin. They will digest those pieces of liquid colloid, and they will chop off or cleave off the T3 and the T4 off of the thyroglobulin and then secrete those thyroid hormones, T3 and T4, into the blood. So that's the whole process. I know you'll have to go through it a few times, just like I did when I was your age. While you're making notes on that, I want to talk about something called a goiter, because you'll hear that term called goiter. All goiter means is an enlarged thyroid gland, and you can see it sometimes visibly in somebody's neck. Goiter doesn't tell you if their thyroid gland is hyperactive or hypoactive or maybe even normal functioning. It just means a big thyroid gland from something, and it's your job to find out. So how does the body know when to secrete T3 or T4 or not? So let's talk about the control of T3 and T4 secretion This is a big picture slide. This is a slide that you can apply to many different hormones in the body. And here we go. The setup is, over to your left, we have the hypothalamus. That's the king above here at the top. Down below that, we have the anterior pituitary gland where all the action is. And then below that, for this slide, we have a piece of the thyroid gland. So your book has sucked out a thyroid follicle and put it on the bottom of the slide. So that's the visual setup. How does it work? Here's the example I'll give. Let's say there are low blood levels of the thyroid hormones T3 and T4 in your blood. Well, the hypothalamus is the king, and the hypothalamus has the job of regulating that. And the hypothalamus can sort of taste that in the blood. It says, hey, we're running a little low on thyroid hormones, and I'm the king, and I'm supposed to do something about it. So what I will do is I will release a releasing hormone. I will send it down to the anterior pituitary gland and tell it to release something. I'll tell it to release TSH, which you know is thyroid stimulating hormone. Thyroid stimulating hormone circulates throughout your body, and TSH stimulates the thyroid gland to raise blood levels of T3 and T4. This, therefore, is a classic example of a negative feedback loop, where the less we had of something, the more we got. So this, again, is a big picture slide. You could apply this general thinking and general principle to most hormones in the human body. On this slide, we're going to talk about the actions of the hormones of the thyroid gland. Let's start with a little bit of a review and look at the figure to the left. It's showing one of the thyroid follicles out of the gland. Remember, the follicular cells are the cells that produce T3 and T4. And by definition, those are the thyroid hormones. They're not the only hormones made by the thyroid gland, but by somebody's definition, not mine, I'm just the messenger, they are the thyroid hormones if anybody asks you. What do T3 and T4 do? They increase something called the basal metabolic rate, typically called the BMR. What is that? You should know. It's the rate at which our metabolic reactions use energy under basal conditions. That means someone who is awake but resting and also fasting. There's different ways to measure the BMR, and many of you will see that done in the clinical world. What else do the thyroid hormones do? Well, if you increase the BMR, you also increase the body temperature. Remember when you studied metabolism and you did all those reactions, of course you produced APT and some water, but also heat was a byproduct of all those reactions. This is a big picture kind of item that you have to take away forever from this course. The thyroid hormones essentially reach out and touch every cell in our body. They regulate our metabolism. If the levels are high, they're going to speed up our metabolic rate. If the levels of thyroid hormones are low, our metabolism is going to slow down. It's a very powerful, wide-ranging hormone. What else do the thyroid hormones do? Something you didn't know. Thyroid hormones also contribute to synthesis of protein and body growth, especially of the nervous and skeletal systems. Make sure you underline and highlight that. You'll see on the next slide how critical that function is. Now, there is another hormone made by the thyroid gland. Remember the parafollicular cells? they make a hormone called calcitonin. It's not one of the thyroid hormones by someone's definition, but it's a hormone made by the thyroid gland. We just have to go with the flow there, guys. What does calcitonin do? Calcitonin decreases blood calcium levels by inhibiting bone resorption, by inhibiting the function of the cells you may remember called osteoclasts. First of all, how do I remember this? It's easy. Calcitonin tones the calcium down in the blood. That's the way I remember it. Calcitonin tones the calcium down. Let's do a little review of bone physiology. Remember, there were osteoblasts that built up your bone and osteoclasts that crunch your bone. Osteoclasts and osteoblasts are kind of in a constant balance. What the clasts do, or the crunchers, is they're like Pac-Man cells and they munch the calcium and the phosphate out of your bone and they put it into your blood. So the way calcitonin works is by calming down those osteoclasts, they inhibit them from crunching the calcium out of your bone. So that's how calcitonin works. While you're making notes on this, I'll give you an example of a real clinical use of this. Someone who knew this a little bit of physiology says, well, hey, there's people with bad bones, right? There's people with osteoporosis. Maybe we could build their bones back up by inhibiting their osteoclasts. And sure enough, if you do an internet search, there's a chemical. I don't know how much it's used anymore, but it's called myocalcin spray. It's actually a nose spray. If you look on the bottle, it says calcitonin derived from a fish, derived from actually salmon. And people jack it up through their nose. It calms down their osteoclasts, so you keep the calcium in your bone and give your bones a chance to build up by letting the osteoblasts sort of overpower the osteoclasts. So yeah, that's a clinical use of calcitonin. How may it affect your body? You've got to know this slide stone cold. Hypo or low secretion of the thyroid hormones during infancy, if not diagnosed and treated promptly, causes stunted bone growth and severe mental retardation, which is called cretinism. You may have heard that term, cretin. That's a derogatory term that really shouldn't be used, but it refers to severe mental retardation. If you understood the functions on the other slide, this makes sense. Remember, one of the functions of the thyroid hormones is growth of the skeletal and nervous systems. So this first bullet point should make sense to you. Furthermore, in most states now, in Florida, it's state law that one of the first things you do when a baby's born, you draw blood and you check the levels of the thyroid hormones. If the thyroid hormones are low, you will supplement them, you will treat the baby. If you miss it, if you don't do the test, if you forget to read the test, if you forget to report the test, that baby will be a dwarf and will be severely mentally retarded permanently because you missed it. Do not miss that. That will be the end of your career. There's no way to win that case in front of a jury of your peers. What about later on in life? Let's talk about hypothyroidism. That means low action of the thyroid gland. If you have low thyroid hormones, it slows down your metabolism. So what happens? You start to gain weight. You actually start to swell up. It's a special kind of edema called myxedema. Your body temperature measurably actually goes down a little bit. So those people are very sensitive to cold. It slows down everything, including your thought processes. So it's called mental dullness. You don't think as clear. And this happens to a lot of people. It's more common in young women. There's an autoimmune disease where the body attacks the thyroid gland. And a lot of times women just kind of blow it off. They say, well, you know, I'm just gaining a little weight and I'm not as sharp as I used to be. And they just ignore it. But if they would have went to the doctor and had a thyroid blood test and got the thyroid supplement, they can really get back to normal. You know, in my face-to-face classes, I make a little joke here. I say, you know, maybe my wife should be checked for this. But during this course, I'm being taped, so I dare not go there. What about hyperthyroidism? That's just the opposite. That's an overactive thyroid gland. So what happens? Your metabolism gets all jacked up. So you start to lose weight. Your body temperature actually goes up a little bit, and people with hyperthyroidism, they don't like to be in hot places. They're heat intolerant. They get very nervous. They might tremor. They get a rapid heartbeat. They develop something called exophthalmos. That means eyes protrude out of the head. Some of those of you who know me might be thinking, hey, he should be checked for that one. And don't worry, I've been checked 3 times. I don't have hyperthyroidism. The point is, look how powerful this chemical is. It affects metabolism throughout the body. You will see many patients with these two diseases. As a matter of fact, it reminds me of a story. I was called one time as an eye doctor to see a patient in the hospital. It was at a major university hospital. I'm not going to name it. And I got called in because the eyes were bulging out of the head. Now, that's not why the patient was admitted to the hospital, but I said, hey, the patient, you know, has the eyes bulging out. They have thyroid disease. And furthermore, I reviewed the chart. The reason they were in the hospital is because they had a really rapid heartbeat, and they couldn't find the reason. And I said to the cardiologist, all you got to do is do a thyroid blood test and treat it, and you'll see there's your answer. And that's exactly what happened. Goiter, once again, all that means is an enlarged thyroid. It doesn't tell you the status of the thyroid gland. It just means it's big. That used to be common in the old days. In the old days, when there wasn't enough iodide in the diet, people developed a goiter because the thyroid gland was going into overdrive, trying to do its job that we discussed on one of the other slides, and it kind of got pumped up like a muscle gets pumped up. It was trying so hard to make thyroid hormones, but it couldn't do it because there wasn't enough iodide. So in the old days, you saw a lot of goiters. Well, here's a picture of one. There's a big thyroid gland right sitting there in the neck. And it always amazed me how late people present to the clinic. People ignore things. They deny things. They think they're going to go away. And sometimes when you see this, you know, what are you wondering? You know, are they thinking if they put a little cream on it, it's going to go away? And why isn't somebody telling them? I mean, if Uncle Joe has this, you should say to Uncle Joe, hey, you got something kind of hanging there. People get diagnosed way too late. You'll be amazed at what walks into your clinic. But you could diagnose this from across the room. Now, don't do anything I say to do in this course. Don't go walking around the street and say, you got it, you. Just know the stuff, okay? Here's an example of exophthalmos. This is typically seen in hyperthyroid patients. This is really not the eyes getting bigger. What's happening is kind of fascinating. It's beyond the scope of this course, so you don't have to write it down. But the same autoimmune disease that might be attacking, the same antibodies that might be monkeying with their thyroid gland, for some reason they have a cross-reactivity with the soft tissue in our eye sockets. So what's actually happening here is there's inflammation in the soft tissue, the eye sockets, and it's causing swelling behind the eyes and pushing the eyes out. I actually got consulted one time with this sort of a scenario, and the eye got pushed all the way through the eyelids and was down on the patient's cheek. And so what I did is I just took the eye and I pushed it back in. Now, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but that's really kind of what happened. That was the emergency treatment. Of course, there was follow-up treatment to that. Let's follow up the thyroid glands with the parathyroid glands. And I love the name. Para means next to or near, and the parathyroid glands are near. As a matter of fact, they're plastered right into the thyroid glands. This drawing from your book is a posterior view. Now you're looking at the back of someone's neck. In yellowish here, those are the lateral lobes of the thyroid gland. And plastered in there, we usually have 1, 2, 3, 4 of these little green pea-sized glands found on the back of the thyroid gland. Now, they're really not this bright green color. That's just what your book uses. Got to do a little histology as well. So if we slice into a parathyroid gland into one of them little peas, what does it look like? Here's a drawing off to your right. This is the parathyroid gland. The only cell I want you to know is the main cell. And the main cell is called the chief cell. The chief cell produces the main hormone from the parathyroid gland, and you guessed it, it's called parathyroid hormone, which is typically abbreviated PTH. What does parathyroid hormone do? Parathyroid hormone increases blood calcium levels. I just remember it this way. Parathyroid with a P pumps the calcium up. How does parathyroid hormone pump my blood calcium up? Three ways you gotta know. And if you already did bone physiology, you already learned this one time. So this is a review. Number one, parathyroid hormone increases the activity of the osteoclasts, which increases something called bone resorption. That term resorption is specific for the bones. That means the osteoclasts, the crunchers, crunch the calcium and phosphate, by the way, out of the bone and put it into the blood. That's one way to raise blood calcium levels. Second way PTH works is PTH goes to the kidneys and it tells the kidneys to hold on to the calcium. That's called increasing the calcium reabsorption. That's a term specific for the kidney. That means return calcium to the blood from the kidney fluid. So in English, it tells the kidneys don't pee out the calcium. Third way we increase blood calcium levels is PTH, also in the kidneys, tells the kidneys to produce more of the hormone called calcitriol, which you know is the most active form of vitamin D, and vitamin D increases dietary absorption. Absorption is the term we use for the digestive system. It tells your small intestine absorb more calcium. So those are the three ways parathyroid hormone pumps up our blood calcium level. Increases bone resorption, increases calcium reabsorption in the kidney, and increases dietary absorption. So while you're making notes on that, let me give you a clinical example of how you'll see this in real life. Someone or some people have a disease called hyperparathyroidism. That means those little P-shaped glands are overactive. And if PTH is too high in the blood, what is it going to do? Well, all these things on this list. And it's going to munch the calcium out of the bone, and those people will have osteoporosis. And it's going to increase their blood calcium level. So you will see people with bad bones and a high calcium reading on their blood test, and I hope you scan their parathyroid glands and you treat them appropriately. How does your body know what to do? How does it know the way to control calcium levels in your blood? Well, check it out. Here's the drawing from your book again. This is the posterior view. We got our yellow thyroid glands. We got our green little parathyroid glands. Note the rich blood supply, very characteristic of endocrine glands. And on this slide it says PTH and calcitonin control blood calcium levels through feedback loops directly. Note the pituitary gland is not involved. This is one of those kind of cases where these glands do not have to talk to the hypothalamus. They do not have to talk to the pituitary gland. Directly, the thyroid and parathyroid combo taste the blood and adjust their hormone levels so you get your calcium just right in your blood. We'll move on now to something very important called the adrenal glands. I like the name adrenal glands. They tell me kind of two things. Number one, the adrenal glands shown here as these mushy yellow pyramids are added on top of the renal glands. So the name tells me they're on top of the kidneys. So yes, they are located superior to each kidney. They do have sort of a flattened pyramidal shape. Adrenal gland helps me one way, in another way, with one of the functions. Adrenal really stands for adrenaline, and adrenaline is one of those compounds that the adrenal glands produce. So the word adrenal helps me a little bit with location and a little bit with function. Let's take a look in more detail, though. Here is a gross anatomy picture. I love these gross anatomy shots. I hope you're enjoying them. Here's a right human kidney, and there is a mushy yellow pyramid-shaped structure slapped on the top like a hat on top of the kidney. That's called the adrenal gland. Here's a basic structure of this gland and almost every other organ in anatomy. This drawing shows you the layout. On the outside of this organ, we have a connective tissue capsule. Just underneath the capsule, we have this outer bark or outer meat of this organ and almost every other organ in anatomy. You know that's the cortex. Then the inner lighter meat, again in this organ and almost every other organ in anatomy, is called the medulla. So capsule, cortex, medulla. It's anatomy 101. It's almost anatomy zero at this point in time. You're probably having dreams or nightmares about it by now. We got to know some detail here and some physiology. You're getting a lot of the histology in lab. You're supposed to be taking it at the same time, but I'll do a mini histology review here, but then I want to really dive into the function. So here is a histological prep off to your left, showing the pink connective tissue capsule. Then underneath it, we have the cortex. And then down below, we have a little bit of the inner meat called the medulla. Let's break it down. The cortex is this layer here that produces three different types of steroid underlined hormones from three separate zones within the cortex. Let's look at the three zones of the cortex, from superficial to deep. The outermost zone just underneath the capsule is called the zona glomerulosa. Why did it get that name? I hope they told you in lab. Because if you look really close, the cells here are arranged like in little balls. And the root word for little ball in anatomy or in Greek is glomerulus. So someone called this zone the zona glomerulosa. The next zone is the biggest, widest zone of the adrenal cortex. It's called the zona fasciculata. How did somebody give it that name? Well, years ago, the first person to find it under the microscope, they said, well, now the cells are streaming in like little cords or bundles. And the Greek root word for bundle is fascicle, so they call this the zona fasciculata. The last zone, if you will, of the adrenal cortex, the deepest one, is called the zona reticularis. Why? Because under the microscope, supposedly, the cells here are arranged more in a lacy or a networky kind of pattern, and retic means a network, and that's why someone called it the zona reticularis. When I look under the microscope, quite honestly, it's hard to see that structure, so I give myself a different memorization technique for this. From superficial to deep, the three zones of the cortex are the glomerulosa, fasciculata, and reticularis. That spells GFR, which is good for remembering. And that's how I never forget the anatomy of the adrenal cortex. Then comes the medulla. The medulla is the inner meat of this and every other organ pretty much in anatomy. We'll see there's some hormones produced there. That's where the adrenaline-like compounds come from, such as epinephrine and norepinephrine. We're going to talk in great detail about each of these layers individually, starting with the zona glomerulosa. What hormone does that make? I want you to know that that makes mostly our old friend aldosterone. Aldosterone is classified as a mineralocorticoid. Don't let that freak you out. It just means it's a hormone that adjusts mineral homeostasis or balance of minerals in our body. How is this hormone level controlled? Through our old friend that we already did, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. What are the functions of aldosterone? Some of this is review because we already did it in a prior unit. The main function of aldosterone is to increase reabsorption of sodium. What follows the sodium? Well, chloride follows the sodium. And what follows the salt? Water follows the salt. So aldosterone increases salt water reabsorption by the kidneys. Remember, this is the add salt water chemical. It's the pump up the volume chemical. Another function I want to throw in here, because we need to know a little bit more. Another mineral besides salt that the aldosterone adjusts is potassium. What it does to potassium, though, is it increases potassium secretion by the kidneys. The way I remember that is the abbreviation for potassium is K, and I just remember K for potassium and K for kick. So aldosterone kicks out the K out of the kidneys, or kicks the potassium out of the kidneys. So yes, aldosterone adjusts minerals, adds salt water, kicks out the K. Let's move on to the zona fasciculata, the middle layer. It secretes mostly a hormone I want you to know called cortisol. Cortisol is classified as a glucocorticoid. Don't let that freak you out either. It's called a glucocorticoid because cortisol mostly affects glucose homeostasis in the body. What controls levels of cortisol? Well, we already did it. It's our old friend ACTH, or adrenocorticotropic hormone. What are the functions of cortisol? A lot. If you look in your book, I'm leaving out a million things, but I want to focus on the key features. Look at these carefully. Number one, cortisol increases the rate of protein breakdown into amino acids and lipid breakdown into fatty acids. Also, cortisol increases new glucose formation in the body. Look what I just said. Cortisol increases production of amino acids, fatty acids, and sugar. Why? Because if you look at that slide in the metabolism chapter, all three of those things could be shoved either directly or indirectly into the Krebs cycle and therefore into the electron transport chain. All of that can be used to increase ATP production for energy. Cortisol is what is allowing us to increase ATP for energy. And if you see a patient in real life or on the test who has adrenal insufficiency or low adrenal function, one of the first things they'll tell you is, "Doc, I just started over the past few weeks. I'm feeling really weak. I'm drained. I'm exhausted." And I'm telling you, if you measure a cortisol level, it's going to be low. Okay, so definitely a clinical application. This hormone is also known as the stress hormone. You'll hear that all the time. You should know that. Why? Because if your body's under stress, I don't care what kind, emotional stress, maybe from the test, physical stress from trauma or surgery, what do you need? You need energy. You need ATP. You need cortisol. And I guarantee if someone comes into your office and says, "Doc, I'm all stressed out. The final exam's coming up next week." If you measure a cortisol level, it will be high. And now you understand why. In higher doses, people found out that cortisol has anti-inflammatory properties, and you all probably know this. I mean, who hasn't gone to the drugstore and bought a tube of hydrocortisone and rubbed it on a red, itchy, inflamed rash on your body? Essentially, hydrocortisone is cortisol. You're rubbing it on your body. So, yes, it does have anti-inflammatory properties. Unfortunately, if we have too high of a dose of cortisol in our body, it goes a step further and it decreases our immune responses. It sort of knocks back our immune system. I'll give you an example. You know, during finals week, we get stressed out, right? Our cortisol level goes up. Cortisol does suppress our immune system. And did you ever notice during finals week, a lot more people getting sick? They got colds, they got sore throats, they break out in fever blisters. That's because cortisol is high. People have used this to their advantage. There are many diseases, such as autoimmune diseases, where the immune system is going wacky. It's overactive. Or there are people who maybe have transplanted organs, like a heart transplant, and you may want to knock back somebody's immune system. So drugs related to cortisol, such as prednisone or solumedrol or Medrol dose packs, are often given to people who have inflammatory diseases or overactive immune diseases to knock them back. It's sort of curious and fascinating to me the way cortisol works. You don't have to know it. I think it's one step beyond our course, but it hooks all the way back into immunology. If you remember that substance called interleukin, interleukin 1 was made by helper T cells, and that helped all other cells in our immune system. It helped activate our killer T cells, it helped activate our B cells so they can make antibodies, and it just so turns out that cortisol knocks back interleukin 1. So it's no wonder if our cortisol goes up, say if we're stressed out, that our immune system gets weak. So fascinating to me. By the way, I hope you're noticing all my slides are kind of set up the same way here. I do that to keep both you and I organized. At the top of the slide, I tell you the zone, then I tell you what the hormone is, then I tell you the control, then I tell you the function. So it's all organized for you that way. Also, I want to stress the importance of the hormones that are made by the adrenal gland. These first two zones we talked about so far, the glomerulosa, where the aldosterone is made, and the fasciculata, where the cortisol is made, you could not live without it. You would die without these two hormones. This is a patient who has excess glucocorticoids, too much cortisol or prednisone or something related in the system. And they develop a classic appearance. It's called Cushing's syndrome. You will see this. They develop a round face. It's called a moon face. They usually develop a hump of fat called a buffalo hump on their back. So hormones even a little bit goes a long way, reaches out and touches many tissues in your body, you'll see people who either due to tumors or due to maybe you administering too much of glucocorticoids, you will see them with this appearance. And once you see it, you'll never forget it. Let's do the last zone of the adrenal cortex, the deepest zone. Remember our mnemonic, GFR, good for remembering. The zona reticularis is the deepest layer of the adrenal cortex, and it makes small amounts of weak androgens. What are androgens? Those are masculinizing hormones. Easy for me to say. In other words, they have the same function of testosterone. Now let's think about that for a minute. Does a man really need any more testosterone-like compounds in his body? And the answer is no. A man gets buckets of testosterone from his testicles. He doesn't need any more testosterone-like compounds floating through his veins. But what about a woman? Does a woman need any male sex hormones for any reason in her body? I'll give you one example, is female libido or sex drive. So yes, there is a purpose to having a male sex hormone in a woman. Also comes my favorite reason. This is the source of postmenopausal estrogens in women after conversion. Let me discuss this because I think it's absolutely fascinating. So a woman, when they reach menopause, what happens to their ovaries? Better or worse? You know, worse, right? I mean, they go down the chute. So what happens to levels of estrogens in a woman's body after menopause? Also, they go down the tubes. So is the woman just, you know, everything is all washed up? Everything is all kaput? No. What happens in a woman after menopause is the androgens made by the zona reticularis are converted by the woman's body into estrogens. So what I'm telling you in English that you should write down is the zona reticularis is essentially the backup ovary in a woman after menopause. And if that doesn't fascinate, and I'm not sure what, if that doesn't fascinate you, I'm not sure what will. But in any case, it is relevant. Many women you may have heard after menopause, they develop a lot of symptoms because those hormonal changes, boy, do they affect us. Some women therefore go for what's called hormone replacement therapy, or HRT. Become very controversial lately. Used to give it out almost like candy, but now there's reports of side effects, serious ones, including cancer. So the trend has been to back off of hormone replacement therapy now. And look, the adrenal gland might kick in here and help out. I mean, hundreds of years ago, could a woman just walk into the doctor and say, I'm going through really bad menopause, give me some hormones? No, of course not. And, you know, they probably did okay because the zona reticularis kicked in as the woman's backup ovary. Cool stuff. I already gave you a memorization technique for the anatomy, right? It goes glomerulosa fasciculata reticularis, GFR. That's good for remembering. Now I'm going to give you a memorization technique for the physiology that you'll never forget. I'm going to make a sandwich. And here's the sandwich I'm going to give you. Remember the zona glomerulosa. That's the outermost layer. That's your G in good for remembering. That made aldosterone. What does aldosterone adjust? It adjusts minerals like salt. So I'm going to make my sandwich with my outermost layer of bread is going to be a salty, crystally, crunchy layer of salt. Then the middle layer of my sandwich, formed by the zona fasciculata, that's your F in your good for remembering, makes cortisol. And what does cortisol mostly adjust? It mostly adjusts sugar levels in our body. So the middle layer of my sandwich is going to be sugar. So thank goodness I'm making a sugar sandwich. The last layer of bread, the deepest layer, remember here that your reticularis, that's your R and your good for remembering, makes androgens, male sex hormones. And what can male sex hormones do? Even in a woman, you might see it. If a woman makes too much of these, what happens? They start to grow hair, like a mustache or a beard or something like that. So my last layer of bread, I'm sorry about this, is going to be hair. So my sandwich for physiology is a salt, sugar, hair sandwich. I know, but you'll never forget. Okay, now we're ready to do the adrenal medulla. Remember, the adrenal medulla is the middle part of the gland, and this is actually part of the sympathetic division of the autonomic nervous system. What controls it? You know this, the hypothalamus. It almost controls everything. What happens there? Special cells within the adrenal medulla that I want you to know are called chromaffin cells, produce the adrenaline-like compounds, including mostly epinephrine with a star and norepinephrine. Both of those hormones will jack up our fight or flight sympathetic responses. Jack up your heart rate, jack up your blood pressure. You know the deal, you already probably studied it. Why are they called chromaffin cells? I want to tell you this. Chroma, root word, means color. And they are colored cells. If you look at your histology slides in the adrenal medulla, they have a little tinge of like a light brown to them. So that's how they got their names. Furthermore, I want you to know that because you're going to see people with a tumor of those cells called a pheochromocytoma. So a pheochromocytoma is a tumor of the chromaffin cells. And what happens is those tumor cells start making what they make. They make a lot of adrenaline-like compounds, including epinephrine and norepinephrine. So here's a true story that you're never going to forget. A friend of mine, again, it was a young lady, she went to the doctor and her heart rate and her blood pressure were both through the roof. And the doctor monkeyed around with medications and stuff for a while trying to control it, but all kind of red flags should have been going off in his head because it's not normal for a young woman to come in with a heart rate and a blood pressure through the roof. When the doctor finally scanned the adrenal glands, he found that there was a tumor of the adrenal medulla called a pheochromocytoma. And with proper treatment of the tumor, my friend's heart rate and blood pressure returned back to normal. It all boils down to understanding the basics. And we've all experienced this sudden rush of adrenaline in our veins. Again, if you've almost ever been smashed in an intersection by someone running the red light, that's essentially your adrenal medullas are just squeezing these hormones and jacking them directly into your bloodstream and getting you all fired up. We'll now move on to another one of our endocrine glands called the pineal gland. We did this when we studied the brain. This is a small part of the epithalamus. It's located about right there on your slide. It produces the hormone melatonin. Melatonin is thought to be responsible for promoting sleepiness and regulating our biological clock. So when darkness comes, this part of our body puts out melatonin. It makes us feel mellow and makes us feel sleepy. Things could go wrong with this. I believe I discussed it in another unit, but I'll mention it again now. You may encounter people with something called SAD. SAD stands for seasonal affective disorder. You often see it in the northern states like Alaska where they don't have as much sunshine. And their body's tricked into thinking it's nighttime all the time. So the pineal gland produces a lot of melatonin. They feel mellow. They feel too mellow, almost depressed because the melatonin levels are so high. So the treatment, by the way, is you give them a special light. It's called light therapy, and the light is supposed to mimic the spectrum of rays that the sun gives off, and that helps them feel less sad, so to speak. Also, your older patients, you'll see with age, we produce less melatonin. That's why your geriatric patients may have sleeping problems, and some people take supplements for that reason. The next gland we'll talk about is an old friend of ours. It's called the thymus gland. The thymus gland, of course, main job, it's part of the immune system, but it also produces hormones called thymic hormones. Remember, those hormones helped the T cells in the thymus gland to mature. I think, again, this is showing you the power of the endocrine system, because here we have hormones that are regulating or help to regulate our immune system, and you know how important that is to our daily lives. Finally, we'll wrap up with another important gland called the pancreas. This organ, remember, has dual functions. It has both endocrine and exocrine functions. We've done the exocrine functions already. Those were the digestive juices that we've talked about in the digestive unit. But now, of course, we're talking endocrine. And there are endocrine cells inside the pancreas. Over to your right, we have a drawing of the gross anatomy of the pancreas. Then we suck out a piece and slap it on a slide to your right, showing you the histology. And about 1% of the pancreas is made up of these lighter colored balls of cells. These islands of cells are actually called pancreatic islets. Most of my friends on the weekends, we call them something else that you should know. They are called islets of Langerhans. Please look that up in your textbook. And that is what most people call them in the real world. These are the islands of cells that produce insulin and other hormones. Here's a gross anatomy picture. I just love looking at these things, so hope you're enjoying them as well. Here's the pancreas cut open. You can even see the pancreatic duct, and there's a little piece of duodenum over to your left where the digestive enzymes get squirted into. But nothing really new on this slide. I just wanted to show you a dissected pancreas. Now we start to break into the good stuff. What are those special cells inside the pancreatic islets, and what do they produce? There's at least four cells, but I'm only going to do two in our course. Let's do first the alpha cell. The alpha cell is the cell that produces glucagon. And glucagon increases blood glucose levels. I like that name. Glucagon sounds like glucose, and glucagon increases glucose in the blood. So that's easier for me to remember. The only other cell I want you to know is the beta cell. And the beta cells are the cells that produce insulin. And insulin decreases blood glucose level. If you know a diabetic, you know that, because when they inject themselves with insulin, that decreases or lowers their blood glucose levels. This slide has a ton of information on it. You need to know this slide inside and out, forwards and backwards, not just for this course, but for the real world. Let's talk about regulation of glucagon and insulin secretion. So a lot of physiology coming at you here. No better way than to do it than by example. So let's start with a patient who has low blood glucose. If I have low blood glucose, that's going to stimulate my pancreas cells to release what? To release glucagon. Because if I want glucose, I want glucagon. So, what does glucagon do? Glucagon is very smart. Glucagon goes to the liver. And the liver, remember, is a metabolic powerhouse. And when glucagon goes to the liver, it does two major things. It increases glycogen breakdown. That's called glycogenolysis. Look, let the word help you. Don't let it freak you out. Lysis means to break down, and glycogen means glycogen. Glycogenolysis means break down glycogen into glucose. Glucagon is also very smart because it tells the liver to produce new glucose from scratch. That's called gluconeogenesis. That's a mouthful, I know, but it's easy. Genesis means to make or to create. Neo means new, and gluco means glucose. So all gluconeogenesis means is make new sugar. Both of these processes will raise our blood glucose levels, hopefully back to normal. Again, I love the word glucagon. Glucagon kind of sounds like going to get some glucose. And where is it going to get some glucose? It's going to the liver because it's really smart. Let's give the opposite example. What about high blood glucose, like in a diabetic? If my blood sugar is high, that's going to stimulate my pancreatic islet cells to produce insulin. And what does insulin do? I love the word insulin. Insulin drives glucose into our body cells where it's needed. And it also increases glycogen formation, which is called glycogenesis. That just means, remember your root word, genesis means to make or to create, and glycogen means glycogen. So glycogenesis means make glycogen. So both of these will lower blood glucose levels. So I love the word, again, insulin, because insulin drives sugar in from my blood into my body cells. And once it's driven into my body cells, it increases storage of glucose as glycogen. You should write down on this part of the slide that most of this is occurring in our skeletal muscle and our liver. That's where most of the sugar is getting driven into cells and stored as glycogen in those cells. Think of all the muscle, all the meat you got hanging off of all your bones. So that's where most of your glucose is getting driven into, as well as your liver. Want to take a little break here while you're maybe making notes and give you an example of how important it is to know this. You may have heard of this happening, and I hope you're never involved in this. There is something called insulin shock. Let me describe this to you. If a healthcare provider accidentally injects too much insulin, and it happens, some people read the syringe wrong and give a whopping dose of insulin, what happens is very quickly this powerful hormone will drive that sugar out of the blood and bottom out that patient's blood glucose. And of course, the brain can't survive without a constant fresh supply, because the brain doesn't store or make its own sugar. It needs a constant fresh supply. So if you bottom somebody's sugar out with too much insulin, they can go into a coma and they can even die. So please pay attention to that insulin syringe and make sure that patient gets the right dosage. There are cases where nurses have given too much by mistake and patients have died. And again, you'll never win that case in front of a jury of your peers. One brief thing on diabetes mellitus. Diabetes mellitus, of course, you may have heard there's type 1 and type 2. And that means either they have the inability to produce insulin, those are usually your type 1 diabetics, or they have the inability to use the insulin that they do make, and those are usually what we call your type 2 diabetics. Before we end this unit, I want to tell you about something that's truly amazing to me, and it's all based on the knowledge that you have. You, someone listening, could have thought of this. Of course, there's a lot of diabetics in this world. Some of them are very difficult to control, even with a lot of insulin injections and a lot of monitoring. Even with the insulin pump, sometimes it's hard to control somebody's blood sugar. And despite our best efforts, they continue to go on to have the effects of the disease, such as maybe blindness, such as maybe kidney disease, and so forth. So someone who was brilliant said, Now, wait a minute. If all of our treatments medically are still not working, is there anything else we can do to help out these poor diabetic patients, especially I'm talking about these type 1 diabetic patients? And they came up with this thing called islet cell transplants. And do an internet search. It's fascinating. Here's how the story goes. Let's say you're an organ donor. You know how in the driver's license you could be an organ donor. By the way, just my personal opinion, that's a very noble thing to do. So when an organ donor dies, one of the things they harvest out of the body is the pancreas. They take the pancreas and they put it into kind of like a blender. It's not really a blender, but that's good enough. And when they blend the pancreas, they have a special way of extracting the islet cells, specifically the beta cells that make the insulin. Then they take those insulin-making islet cells and they put them into a syringe. Usually, it's an interventional radiologist, I believe, who does this procedure. Under X-ray guidance, the doctor takes the syringe full of insulin-making cells from the organ donor and injects them into the hepatic portal vein. And you know that vein transports things to the liver. And you also know, and the doctor who invented this knows, that the liver is a metabolic powerhouse with a very rich blood supply that is capable to do almost anything. And the person who invented it said, hey, maybe if we inject them there, they'll grow there like seeds grow and they'll start to produce insulin. And sure enough, that is what is happening. They inject it through the hepatic portal vein. The islet cells that make insulin seed the liver. They grow there. They produce insulin. And now if you look it up, some type 1 diabetics are actually being cured with what are called islet cell transplants. Now, it doesn't always work, and it's not the right procedure for every patient. It's still rather new, but to me, it's just fascinating that someone thought of that. And with the anatomy and physiology base that you have right now, you could have been that one to thought of that process. So please, we're not just taking this course to ace it, we're taking it to understand it and help people.